sounds good. Forget, I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't.
Welcome to Forgive the Wait, a podcast that focuses on debunking many misconceptions regarding sexual abuse. Here are your hosts, Kim and Nikki. Hi, Nikki. How are you doing tonight?
I'm all right. How are you doing, Kim?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. I'm excited to be back and doing the podcast again. It's been quite a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had a lot going on here. You know, as I reported in our last podcast, my aunt passed and Nikki had lost her voice and she no longer sounds like a teenage boy going through puberty. So we're doing good.
Oh, thank you.
And what you don't know is on the podcast that I released last week, that little one, is I told everybody that you sounded like a teenage boy going through puberty. So.
Oh, lovely.
Well, that's great. Well, we're going to be back and doing regular updates now, and we have today's topic that we're ready to start, and it is about why people don't report abuse. The first thing that I want to talk about is a section from the book, The Courage to Heal, and it is about the levels of telling. There are many levels of telling, ranging from the first time you dare to broach the subject to when you have told so many times and in so many ways that you can talk about it naturally as just another part of your life. Each time you tell is a different experience. Telling your therapist or your support group, telling your partner or a new lover, telling a friend, telling publicly, telling in writing, they will all feel different. You may tell with detachment, with sadness, with anger, or occasionally even with humor.
So one of the first things that we were going to talk about today is dealing with child sexual abuse first, and then we're going to talk about adult victims of sexual assault in the second part. Is that correct, Kim?
That's right. That's what our goal is anyways. We may deviate from that here and there, but you guys will get the gist of it.
Okay. One of the first things when we were talking about this, I went back and did some research, and I found an interesting article in Child Abuse and Neglect called Why Children Tell, a Model of Children's Disclosure of Sexual Abuse. And this is was taken from, this is a study where they took data from 218 child abuse allegations or child abuse, sexual abuse victims who had been referred to the district attorney's office. And Kim knows that I work in social work and work with children who are at risk of abuse or have been abused. And for it to rise to the level where it's referred to the district attorney's office, there is usually a pretty strong evidence. There's pretty strong evidence that there's been abuse. So, what this article talks about is about different factors that seem to relate to delay between the time that abuse happened and when it's disclosed. So, one of the things that is a significant factor for reasons why children might delay in disclosing sexual abuse is a fear of negative consequences. And there are several different types of negative consequences. One is being afraid that they'll be punished if they believe, if adults believe that they're lying. Another part is guilt or shame and embarrassment. And one of the things that this article talked about is there are lots of different ideas about what is more likely to happen. Like, would older children be less likely to tell because they feel responsible? Or would younger children be less likely to tell because they have that whole thing of magical thinking of, you know, I caused this to happen, you know, like if you step on a crack and you'll break your mother's back kind of thinking.
Oh, right.
And research is kind of conflicting, but there are some basic ideas that come through that are consistent across the research. One of the things that we were just talking about was feeling like if I tell, then people are going to say that I'm lying. So what's your experience with that, Kim?
My personal experience with that is the first time that I ever told anybody was when I was in high school, and I told a girlfriend of mine, and it wasn't that I told her I was being sexually abused by my brother. It was that I told her of one thing that he would do, and she just was, she was disgusted and awestruck. And I said, you know, please don't tell anybody. My brother goes to school with me. He's in a grade higher than me. Please don't tell anybody. I don't want this to get back. I'm scared. And I guess it was just too much for her to handle herself, and so she needed to talk to somebody else about it. It turns out that one of her best friends was very close friends with my brother's girlfriend at the time. And when she found out about it, she went and told my brother's girlfriend. And in turn, my brother's girlfriend went and told my brother and said, "Can you believe what your sister is saying?" And so he and his girlfriend went back to my house, and they talked to my mom before I got home from school. And when I got home from school, the three of them started yelling at me. And I set my school bag down, and they cornered me in the kitchen, you know, in the corner where a door meets the wall and where the refrigerator was. And I had no place to go. I couldn't run. I couldn't do anything. So, you know, they're standing there screaming at me. Jason, my brother, is yelling at me, you know, "Why would you lie like that? Why would you say something? How dare you? What the hell's wrong with you?" And he's cursing at me left and right, his girlfriend was just joining in with him, saying, you know, "That's just disgusting. Why would you say something like that about your brother? That's stupid." And my mom's screaming at me that, you know, I can't believe that something like that would have happened. You have to have been lying. You know, how could you lie like that? And they're just screaming at me. And my mom's like, "Did it happen? You know, how could you say something like that? Did it happen?" And of course, they literally had me cornered in the kitchen. And I was so intimidated, and I was so scared, and I was already so ashamed that I said no. I said, "No, it didn't happen. It didn't happen." And also resulting from that same situation, the same girl that I told at school, somehow it got back to my guidance counselor, and the guidance counselor had, you know, sent an aide down with a note for me to come down to her office. And I thought, "Oh my God, please don't let this be what I think it is." And I went into her office, and there sits the girl that I told and the guidance counselor. So with me and this girl sitting behind the lady's desk, she looks at me, this is my perception of it. I felt no compassion. I felt it was very confrontational. But she looks at me and she says, "Kim, this is what Tina told me. Did this happen?" And I said, "No, I don't know what she's talking about. She must be lying." And I could feel my entire body filling with heat. I know that my face was flushed and beet red. I just didn't know what to do. And all I could do was say, no, this didn't happen. And, you know, maybe it would have been different. And I'm pretty sure it would have been different had the guidance counselor called me down and not had this girl in her office and had actually showed compassion towards me and said, "Kim, you know, we heard this was said. Did this happen? And if it did, I'm so sorry. How can I help you?" That would have been so much better. But I was met with confrontation, and I was met with the girl who I had trusted my story with, you know, and it was a total betrayal of trust. And no, I didn't want anybody to know this. No, I didn't. I thought I was going to be blamed. It was a confrontational approach to me. It was a terrible experience. And, you know, I didn't tell anybody, you know, for years after that.
So. And that goes to one of the things that we're going to talk about in a little bit about the whole environment that a kid is in that's going to tell about sexual abuse is one where adults really want to protect themselves from the idea that somebody that they know is being abused. And so they do become confrontational, and they talk about, you know, their groundless accusations, and somebody's being seductive or vindictive, and that's that whole environment that you step into when you decide, okay, I'm going to tell. So when you make a decision to tell, you're stepping into an environment where people are almost geared towards not believing you. They're going to make accusations. They're going to find a way to try and make it be not true, because they're trying to protect themselves from knowing somebody who's been abused.
Right. And I think a lot of that has to do with, it's not that they don't believe you, it's that they don't want to believe that it could happen. It's more of a disbelief type thing, and it's
right, you know, right, they're trying to protect themselves from
right
it.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about so one of the things that comes into play for kids when as far as a delay in disclosing is if it's somebody who is closer in your family circle, like a parent, or a natural parent is the ones they found are the, it takes the longest for a child to disclose, but also family members, and then the further out you go, the quicker children will tend to tell.
Right, and that has a lot to do with the closeness and the conflict of interest, because the family is, they're supposed to love you, they're supposed to take care of you, they're supposed to protect you, and it's confusing to the children, because you've got this person who's supposed to care for you and all of this stuff, and they're doing this to you.
Yeah, and there's a fear that if you tell that you're going to be betraying a parent, there's fear that you're going to get punished for telling. Also family disruption, because kids know that these things are going to have a big impact on the family. So they get really afraid of what's going to happen when I tell. You know, it'll really tear up the family. Another thing that comes up is that kids will feel like they have a tendency to feel more responsible, or like they're at least partially to blame for it when it's somebody within the family. Now, all of these things are just kind of generalities. It's not that this is the one thing that happens. It's just these are the tendencies of things as far as like looking at what contributes to kids deciding not to tell or to put off telling.
Yeah, there's other things that cause children not to tell. I mean, parents mm-hmm. or family members, or even people who aren't family members, you know, friends and stuff, they will tell you you have to keep this a secret, or they'll threaten you, or they'll threaten your family or somebody that you love. They'll threaten your teddy bear. I mean, mm-hmm. it's disgusting. I mean, it's, you know, it has a certain level of amusement to it, but it's not funny. I mean, to a kid, that teddy bear is the big thing in their life. That is their lovey, their cuddle. It's what keeps them safe. It's what comforts them at night when they sleep. And when you threaten them, they don't want harm to befall their family, their mom, their dad, a cousin, a sister, or their teddy bear. You know,
yeah,
you get that threat.
That's exactly right on. One of the things that they found really interesting in this research project they did is that the fear of something that would happen, a consequence, a hurt to somebody else besides the self or the person who's the victim of the abuse, or the perpetrator, the fear that somebody else, like other family members, or, you know, in their non-offending parent, they're afraid of what will happen to those people more so than they're afraid of what will happen to the perpetrator or even themselves.
Right, because as you and I both know, a lot of times when the abuse is happening is, you know, we kind of dissociate ourselves. We put ourselves outside of the situation, and we don't really feel a lot of the full effects of it at the time. A lot of it comes much later in life, you know, when we start having a whole lot of problems and finally realizing what caused those problems, and then we start to feel all of that stuff. So that's why mm-hmm. at that point when they're children, they're so much more worried about other people and thinking, oh my God, how is this going to affect them, rather than how is it going to affect themselves?
Exactly. And there is that sense even among, like, if you have one child, like an oldest child who's been sexually abused, and then you have younger children of the same gender, or even, you know, if there's a fear on the part of the older child that the younger children will be sexually abused, that's when they tend to come forward a lot, because they think, well, I don't care if it happens to me, but I don't want it to happen to my little sister or my little brother.
Oh, that's so right.
Yeah. And also, that's another threat that people will use inside a family, like let's say the offender is a stepfather. We'll just use that as an example. A stepfather will say to a kid, you know, if you tell or if you stop doing what it is I'm asking you to do or having you do, forcing you to do, then I will start molesting your sister or brother. So that's another form of coercion.
That's right. It certainly is. You find that a lot, unfortunately. And the kids that do tell in that situation, they're like, oh, God, no, you know, he can't do that. And if I tell, somebody's going to stop it. And then you're met with a certain level of what's going to happen once you do tell. And some kids are met with, you know, what am I supposed to do about it? Or blame,
oh, yes.
Victim blaming, which is another topic that we're going to talk about, probably not today, but on another podcast. It's a lot of it has to do with, you know, the victim blaming, you know, well, what did you do, you know, or the abuser will say to the child that, hey, you asked for it, you know, and if you tell, I'm just going to tell them that this is what you wanted, you know, and that's when a lot of the self-hate and the shame comes into play, is feeling like, did I really want that? And, you know, some kids even at some point convince themselves, maybe I did want it.
So, yeah, that's a really important point, is that you know, you have this whole sense of, I'm not worth that much. If it happens to me, it's no big deal, you know, that disassociation thing. And then that part that says, well, if I tell, then all these other things are going to happen. And, you know, and then there's the whole thing of, well, you know, I really enjoyed it. You know, I liked what happened, or, you know, had sexual feelings. And there's that sense of, you know, if I enjoyed it or I got something out of it.
Yeah, then, the arousal.
Yeah, and that's my, you know, then I'm responsible for it. But one of the things that happened when I was little, when I was probably 6 or 7 years old, my parents were in the military. They were in the Army. And we were living overseas. And my parents went on a vacation by themselves to visit some, they were living in Europe, and they went to some country, I think they went to Holland, and they left us with my dad's commanding officer's family. And their son was a preteen. I was like 6 or 7, my sister was 5 or 6, she's a year younger than me, and they left, their parents left us with the babysitter, who was an older teenager, probably at least 16 or 17 years old. And the boy, whose name was Philip, and this babysitter, and I don't even remember her name, got it into their heads to start trying to get my sister to show her privates, and tried to get me to do it. And my sister actually ended up being sexually abused by that boy, to the point, you know, where he was trying to rape her. And there came a point, because I kept saying, I'm going to tell. And so they actually locked me, the babysitter, locked me and the boy in a room together. And he showed his penis and said, if you don't, you know, you have to show me yours or you're not getting out of the room. And so I pulled down my pants and showed mine and all that. But anyway, all this stuff happened, and then after, you know, I kept saying, I'm going to tell. And then my parents got back from their trip, and me and my sister were alone in the car with my mom.
Wait a second. You were telling the boy and the babysitter that you were going to tell?
Yes.
What did they say to that?
Their response to that was to get me to show mine, because then I couldn't tell because I had done it too.
Oh.
That was kind of their way of dealing with that. And I think at some point, I don't know how that ended, you know, memory of that age is kind of weird, but what happened was me and my sister were sitting in the back seat of my mom, in the car with my mom driving, and I was telling my sister, I'm going to tell, and I told my mom, you know, it's like this big buildup here, you know, what you're supposed to do is go tell, you know, that's what they tell kids that age, you know, something bad happens, go tell. And so I told my mom. And I don't remember what I told her, but she knew what we were talking about, or what I was talking about. And I still remember my mom was looking in the rearview mirror at me, and her eyes were really mean looking, and she said, "So what do you want me to do about it?"
Oh, no.
And I was just kind of like, what? You know, I did my part. I was supposed to tell, and this is the response I got. And I was like, I think I said something like, I don't know. And my sister was mad at me because I had told and nothing happened. She started to cry. My mom just kept driving. And we never talked about it again until we were adults. And that, you know, that's that, you know, when you get into that thing about telling, you're sitting there going, you know, well, if I tell somebody, and that's one thing that they talk about in The Courage to Heal, is that children tell. They tell people, adults, adults don't always realize what they're being told, or the response that the kid gets is just so unsupportive and unhelpful that the kid says, well, screw that, I'm never doing that again. And that was definitely my reaction to that. It's like, I will never do that again.
Yeah, for good reason, too.
Yeah, I mean, my sister was so mad at me. I risked my relationship with my sister to tell an adult, and that's what happened. And we never spoke about it again until we were adults.
Wow.
And as adults, it's interesting. My mom said, well, you know, that was, you know, your dad's commanding officer, and your dad would have blown up. See, I didn't even know my dad didn't know until later as an adult. But, you know, he would have gone over there and beat the kid up, and then your dad would have been put in jail. And I'm sitting there going, you know.
So she's making excuses for everybody else.
Right. And the other part of it is, who would really put my dad in jail when this guy's been, you know, molesting his children?
Right, right.
I mean, there is some political whatever to that, you know, that, you know, we live in a fishbowl and everybody will know. But right. That was my mom's crap.
But you know, it comes back to every parent's job, and that is to protect your child at all costs. It doesn't matter what you do. You protect your child.
And that's one of the things that's really interesting about this whole thing. And I hope that you guys, when you're listening, you think about this. The first time that you maybe said something like, you know, I don't want to go over to Susie's house, or you know, I don't want to skate anymore or play volleyball anymore, or whatever it was. There's ways that we tell, and we listen, and we look for the responses that people give. And we make decisions at that age. We make decisions, and we don't realize all the other stuff that's going on. Like, I didn't realize, you know, here we are talking about my dad's CO, and this is going to create all kinds of drama. Now, I didn't need to know that. It wasn't my business to know that.
Right.
But it's interesting to, as you grow up, you realize more and more about what's going on, and you can look at things differently and say, oh, well, here's how, you know, my mom was, you know, dealing with her own crap in this situation. Now, it doesn't make, like in my situation, it doesn't make what my mom did right, but it makes me feel differently about me telling. Because at the time, it was just like, oh my gosh, what did I do? I felt like I had, you know, got caught shoplifting or something.
Oh, right. And let's go back to the point of why we're doing this podcast. And it is because we want to teach society a different way to think about things and a different way to see things, and not just to dismiss because you think it means nothing. When you hear, if you're a parent or if you're around children, listen to those kids. Watch their actions. See what they do. Hear what they say. Really hear. Don't just listen. You need to hear it. Do something about it. Don't just turn a blind eye. I know it's so much easier to turn a blind eye and not do anything, because it does. It takes a lot of effort to go and help somebody or act on somebody else's behalf. But what you really have to do is think about what that child is going to grow up to be, what kind of person that child is going to grow up to be, and how they're going to live their life having been abused like that and having not been believed or for nobody else to pick up the signs of anything. You really need to pay attention. And if a child says to you, you know, somebody is touching me, you need to say what happened. And then you need to act on that child's best behalf, be it talking to a parent. And if nothing happens from there, don't just end it at that. Don't just say, well, I told the parents, you know, it's in their court now. But if the parents don't do anything about it, you have to take it a step further. That's your responsibility. You know, it may not be your child, but it is your right to protect the children. You know, it's not just one person raises a child. It's the entire tribe raises the child. We all protect. no woman is born with the innate knowledge of how to take care of a child. Nobody is. You learn from other people, and you ask questions, and you get insight from here and there. You read books. You get input from all different sources. And that's why it's important if a child tells you, hey, I've been touched, or hey, this is going on, you need to do something about it because you are part of that tribe. And obviously that child trusts you enough to, you know, to tell you or to let out those signs in your presence. Talk to somebody. Do something. Go to the police, call Child Protective Services. Let that child know that they can trust you, be an outlet. Let the child come over, try and spend more time with that child. You know, do what you can.
And that's another thing that's really important as far as we're assuming that most of the people who are listening to this have had some experience with sexual abuse or assault. And it's really, really important to face your own demons and to address sexual abuse and your own history of being a victim. Because one of a really key factor in the, quote, blindness of the non-offending parent, which is just a social work term or a child welfare term for the person who was not the sexual abuser, but the maybe the caretaking parent who was in the home and was oblivious or did know or whatever. One of the keys that they found for people who are the non-offending parent who have been sexually abused themselves is that they're not wanting to see it because seeing it means facing their own pain. And if you've been abused as a child, if you were sexually abused as a child, the last thing you want to hear or to see or to know is that your child's being abused. So it's really important to heal and to face your demons and to address the issues so that you are available emotionally for your children in a way that will take care of those warning signs.
I completely agree with that. And it's funny that you mentioned that because I went to a counseling session with my mom and her counselor tonight. And that was one of the things that we had talked about was how when my parents actually found out, you know, the truth about what happened 6 years ago, my mom didn't want to believe it. And I just couldn't understand how she was just so irrational about it and trying to find reasons and why would this happen? And I was always around and I can't believe this happened and I don't want to know what happened. And it was a couple of months ago when my mom came over to my house and I made her and my dad dinner and they sat down with me and they, you know, they talked to me about trying to figure out if my story was true and asking questions and comparing my story to my little brother's story, who was also abused by my brother. I had asked some questions about, you know, were either of you guys abused? And for the first time, my mom told my dad and I that she had been abused, sexually abused by two different people when she was a child. And she had never told anybody before. And at that moment, I realized why my mom was reacting in the way that she was is because she had never even told anybody that she had been abused, which meant that she had never even dealt with her abuse before. And it made so much sense about why she reacted to the abuse that I had suffered and the fact that it was her son, you know, had compounded it all. And it made sense. It didn't make it right. It didn't make right her reactions, but it made sense on why she was reacting that way because suddenly, you know, she's somewhat on a similar level to I am. So what you just said makes a whole lot of sense. Working your way through your demons is well worth it. Both Nikki and I know this. It's a hard, hard struggle. You're going to make it, though. You're going to be fine. The worst of it is over. But as long as you can make it through, you're going to be prepared to handle what comes along. And you'll probably learn a lot along the way.
So we've kind of talked about the issue of disclosing in a hostile environment, an environment where people are just not receptive. And it's not that they want to call you a liar or it's just some gratuitous thing. It's because they're trying to protect themselves from the knowledge and the pain of realizing that somebody they know has been abused. And that's both deliberately and sometimes subconsciously. Another aspect is helplessness. When children have been abused, they're in an authority relationship with a parent or a caretaker or just other adults, because children are surrounded in their environment with the idea that they have less power and less say and less credibility than adults do. And so a big part of what goes on around the whole idea of being helpless or deciding not to disclose is this feeling of helplessness. So the idea, that idea that a kid should tell right away when they've been abused, doesn't take into account this fact that kids are not equals with adults.
You know, they know that they have to look up to adults, and so many kids have adults that are their idols, and what they need to do is they need to look up to them and say, gosh, or not what they need to do is that they look up to those adults and they say, wow, I want to be an adult. I can't wait until I turn 18. I can't wait until I turn 21. I mean, they're just so envious of people who are adults. And, you know, they constantly look up to them. So they're obviously, you know, not equal. And it's kind of intimidating to them to talk to an adult, you know, on something that's an emotional and that makes you vulnerable. So what needs to happen is the adults need to talk to children on their level. You can't always talk to the children as if, you know, they're on your level. You got to get down to the child's level and talk to them about things that they do and how they feel and really sympathize and empathize with them even.
And there's another part to this. One of the, this whole idea that kids are going to take care of themselves, that they're going to speak up if something bad happens, not taking the authority relationship into account. Another part of that is that children, that people will say, well, if a kid is consenting, you know, behaving in a way that says, you know, complies with whatever the abuser is doing, or somehow, you know, is not complaining about what's going on and just goes along with it, well, then the kid must want it or must be, you know, must like it or something. And that is just another part of that thing where especially with teenagers, you know, teenagers are not adults, they're teenagers. And they're very aware of adult and authority relationships. And sometimes, you know, children and teenagers will behave in sexually provocative ways. Now, I can give a good example of this in my odd life story, in the sense of when I was living on the streets and I was involved in prostitution, I would have sex, consent to have sex with adult men. And I did that a lot. And I had other friends who were, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, even 17 years old. We were doing the same kinds of things. The thing is that when I was involved in that, the adults had access to cars, to money, to a house or a shelter, to food, to cigarettes and alcohol. You know, those were a part of that life that I was living at the time as well. And so they had access to it and I did not. So to get what I wanted or needed, I had to find ways to get them to give me those things. And from the outside looking in, you can say, well, here's this kid out here living on the streets who's, you know, saying, hey, I'll give you a blowjob. I don't know if you want to say that on this show. But I'll give you a blowjob for some money, or, you know, I'll have sex with you if you let me spend the night at your house and, you know, feed me dinner. You know, that seems consenting, but it's not a relationship of equal power. If I had had access to a car and a house and food and money, would I have been doing that? No, I wouldn't. Because that was one of the big reality checks when I was living on the streets. There's very little that somebody, even 16, 17 years old, there's very little that somebody of that age group can do without an adult. You can't rent an apartment without an adult when you're that age. You can't even rent a hotel room. You can't, you know, earn money. You can't go out and get a job. The only thing you have is the ability to be sexual.
Right, and legally, you're not an adult until you turn the age of 18. And before that point, the parents are responsible for making decisions and taking care of the child. So the parent needs to make a decision. So basically, if an adult comes to a child and says, hey, you want to do this? Well, that's not the proper chain of command. What the adult needs to do is the adult needs to go to the parent and say, hey, can your child do this? And now if any adult went to a parent of, say, a 10-year-old girl or a 10-year-old boy and said, hey, do you mind if I have sex with your kid? What do you think the parent's going to say? Absolutely not. And that's why they don't do it.
And that is very important. As a adult woman, I have children in my life, like friends have kids. I have nieces and nephews and different things. And I'll tell you, that's something that's very important to me, that I make sure when I talk to a kid about doing something, that they talk to their parent. I never want to have something going on between me and a child that is a secret. Not because I'm going to do anything to them, but I don't want to train them to accept those kind of rules of relationships with adults.
It's kind of neat that you talk about secrets like that. You don't want to keep a secret. And one of the things that I'll share is about my son. I teach him that secrets are bad. There is no such thing as a good secret. And if somebody tells you, you know, hey, I'm going to tell you a secret, or what we just did is a secret, he knows that he has to come to me or his dad right away and say, hey, so-and-so did this or so-and-so said that. Now, what he knows is that surprises are a good thing. And because surprises are such a good thing, eventually people find out. Now, if it's a secret, you're told not to tell. And that's why I think it's great that, you know, I teach him that way, that secrets are bad. And if anybody tells you have a secret, you know to come and tell me. And I tell him all the time, it doesn't matter what somebody tells you or if they threaten you or if they, you know, threaten me. It's okay. I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to take care of you. And it's not going to be a problem. You know, I constantly reassure him, even though nothing has ever happened with my son, I make sure to educate him. You know?
And I think that's really good. I want to clarify again the difference in what you're saying. The difference between a secret and a surprise is, in a surprise, the person is eventually going to know. So buying a birthday present or a Christmas present or having a surprise party, those are things that the adult, the mommy or the daddy, is going to know about. It's not something that you're going to have to keep a secret forever.
Right, right.
So that's, I think that's a good way to put it. I like the way you said that.
Thank you. Thank you. I was very proud of that.
Yeah. So, and that helplessness, when we're talking about, you know, children, you know, are in a power relationship where they have much less power than the adult does, it is a real important part too. And when a child is continually exposed to that, you know, and one of the things that my therapist says that I really like is he talks about a subset of authority relationships. Authority relationships are when two people have, either an adult and a child or an adult to an adult, it's when the two people have different rights and different responsibilities, such as the case with a parent. A parent has the right to tell a child, yes, you can spend the night with so-and-so, or no, you can't spend the night with so-and-so. But they also have the responsibility to take care of the child, to take, you know, safeguard them and all that stuff. A child, on the other hand, has the right to food, clothing, shelter, and they don't have the same kinds of responsibilities to the adult that the adult has to the child. Now, the subset of an authority relationship is called a fiduciary relationship, and a fiduciary relationship is also a parent-child relationship, but it's also things like a therapist and patient, or a doctor and patient, or a priest and a member of the congregation. And in that relationship, it's a one-way street. The person who has the responsibilities they have special responsibilities and special expectations in the relationship. They, you know, with a therapist, you should expect that your therapist is not going to have sex with you. You expect that your therapist is going to keep the things that you tell them in confidence. You expect that your therapist is not going to exploit your relationship, you know, and and use the confidences and the trust that you've built in an abusive way. And on the other hand, you as a client or a patient or as a child have rights, you know, like children have the right to be taken care of. And so for somebody who is in charged with the safekeeping and the guarding of another human being, it's a double betrayal of that sense of the helplessness or the not being the one in authority and control. It's a double betrayal of that relationship to cross that boundary and to do things like sexually abuse.
I have an excellent idea. Let's change the subject.
Okay.
I think we've talked about children enough. Let's talk about a lot of the adult victims, because I know that we have so many adults that are listening to our podcast. Let's talk about why a lot of the adults don't report abuse. One of the first things that comes to mind is why an adult doesn't report, you know, being sexually assaulted or abused. They're scared that the abuser is going to come back at them. There's a lot of fear involved, and a lot of times when that happens as adults, you know, it's not just the fear that the abuser is going to come back at them just because of their own internal stuff. It's that the abuser a lot of times threatens them or is physically abusive on top of that. You know, and then there's the people that don't want to report because there is a societal stigma of being attached to, you know, the title of a victim of a sexual crime. And it's society's views is, what do people view as a victim of rape or sexual abuse? People think of women, they think of a woman running around screaming, going, oh my God, I don't know what to do. And they think that all female victims of sexual abuse hate all men. I mean, I had that conversation with my little brother about a year and a half ago, you know, and I was telling him that I'm a member of some groups online. And when, you know, women are just scared of men, he's like, yeah, I know. Most women, you know, that are abused hate all men. I said, no, that's not it. It's not that we hate all men. Yeah, I know they hate all men, he tells me. No, you don't get it. It's not that we hate all men. We're just scared because if our abuser was a man, we kind of have that preconceived notion when we're with another man that something like that could happen. We're more cautious and we're a little bit more scared.
And this also applies to men who've been a victim of sexual abuse or sexual assault. There is this fear that they're going to be seen as homosexual, and they may be homosexual, and there's a fear, whether you're heterosexual or homosexual, that you're not manly, you know, that you let somebody do something to you, and that's a real stigma also attached to a sexual
assault. Right, and as a man, society views you as you're supposed to be strong enough, you're supposed to be able to fight off other people, you're supposed to be able to protect yourself and everybody else around you, you're the guy.
Right. So that's a big issue, and hopefully at some point we can have an interview with a male survivor, because I think it would be really good to be able to get some of the perspective from a man's view of these kinds of issues.
Yeah. So if there are any male survivors out there listening, and you would be interested in doing an interview with us, please go ahead and send us an email to forgivethewait@gmail.com.
Another part of this, as far as being a victim of a sexual crime, is this whole idea that somehow sexual crimes are dirty or different. I mean, they've even, one of my favorite shows is Law and Order in all its incarnations. And one of the terms that they've used on the show, and I've heard it elsewhere, is the panty police. And that's that, you know, it's kind of a little thing that the guy's a little titter about, like, that's funny or something. But it's that whole idea that this is a dirty thing. You don't ask somebody who has been robbed or mugged on the street, you don't say, well, what kind of car were you driving? What kind of clothes were you wearing? Did your wallet look really fat? What were you doing at that ATM at that time of night? People don't ask the same kinds of questions of a victim of a mugging or a robbery or something like that, that they ask of victims of sexual assault and rape.
Right, and it comes back to, if you guys have ever seen this little foreword that has gone around the internet, it's called The Rape of Mr. Smith. Have you ever heard of that?
You were telling me about that the other day. Do you have it?
Yeah, let me pull it up here. The following is an internet forward that I've seen for a number of years. It's called The Rape of Mr. Smith by Anonymous. The law discriminates against rape victims in a manner which would not be tolerated by victims of any other crime. In the following example, a hold-up victim is asked questions similar in form to those usually asked a rape victim of. Mr. Smith, you were held up at gunpoint on the corner of 16th and Locust?
Yes.
Did you struggle with the robber?
No.
Why not?
He was armed.
Then you made a conscious decision to comply with his demands rather than to resist?
Yes.
Did you scream or cry out?
No, I was afraid.
I see. Have you ever been held up before?
No.
Have you ever given money away?
Yes, of course.
And you did so willingly.
What are you getting at?
Well, let's put it like this, Mr. Smith. You've given away money in the past. In fact, you have quite a reputation for philanthropy. How can we be so sure that you weren't contriving to have your money taken from you by force?
Listen, if I wanted...
Never mind. What time did this holdup take place, Mr. Smith?
About 11 p.m.
You were out on the streets at 11 p.m. Doing what?
Just walking.
Just walking? You know it's dangerous being out on the street that late at night. Weren't you aware that you could have been held up?
I hadn't thought about it.
What were you wearing at the time, Mr. Smith?
Let's see. A suit. Yes, a suit.
An expensive suit?
Well, yes.
In other words, Mr. Smith, you were walking around the streets late at night in a suit that practically advertised the fact that you might be a good target for some easy money. Isn't that so? I mean, if we didn't know better, Mr. Smith, we might even think you were asking for this to happen, mightn't we?
Look, can't we talk about the past history of the guy who did this to me?
I'm afraid not, Mr. Smith. I don't think you would want to violate his rights now, would you? And that is The Rape of Mr. Smith. Now, if that's generally how rape victims are asked questions in court, it's terrible. But you would never, ever walk into a courtroom and see this story actually happening. Okay.
So there's also the fear of being blamed for the assault, which is kind of what we were talking about. You know, if you're wearing an expensive suit, oh, you must be asking for it.
Oh,
so
right.
There is a lot of...
Of wearing a suit or wearing a low-cut top or a black mini skirt or lots of
or
makeup.
Drinking.
Yeah.
Or being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right. And if a guy walks you to your car and, you know, he's nice enough to walk you to your car and... Well, you know, if you let him...
Or you were dating.
Yeah, and, you know, it's just... Well, that's what you must have wanted. You let him walk you to the car. You let him kiss you a little bit earlier in the night, right? No. That's not how it works.
Oh.
Sorry, I didn't mean to burst your bubble, Nikki.
I don't know what to say. Seriously. Being afraid of being blamed is a very big part of what goes on. Another part, and this comes up a lot for in what I've seen. I've seen, and I just recently had a situation where this kind of stuff came up. People who have mental health issues, people who have been assaulted in the past, people who have anything about their life that's not just fitting the perfect little pristine stereotype of somebody who, you know, is a blameless victim, will think about those things when they consider telling about an assault. And this came up for me in a very real way when I was talking on the last podcast about how I had been held captive by a guy for several weeks when I was hitchhiking, when I was 14 years old. And looking back as an adult, as a woman, as a social worker, I can say, you know, there were so many things that he did that were coercive. You know, he gave me sedatives to keep me from being able to think clearly. He took my clothes
away.
Huh?
Or to even let you get away.
Right. He took my clothes away when he was out of the car, or out of the truck, I'm sorry. He would take my clothes, so I had no clothes. And all of this stuff happened while I was on that, you know, while I was being held by that guy. And still, when I got away from him, I didn't even consider going to the police because I said, I'm a runaway. I've been involved in prostitution, and people won't believe me. They'll find a way to make this my fault.
Right. It's the victim blaming. Well, you could have done this differently, or you could have done that differently, or why didn't you fight him, or why didn't you get out, or why didn't you just run naked? Somebody would have helped you.
Or what were you doing out there anyway? Why did you get in the truck with him?
Right. But nobody ever says, why did that man do that, or how could he do that? It doesn't matter what happened to that kid. Why would that man be so terrible and mean and give you sedatives and keep you held captive in the cab of his truck? You don't hear that. All you hear is the victim could have done this, the victim could have done that. And that's wrong. We need to talk about the people who are doing this, and we need to stop them from doing this. We need to let people know that it's not okay to blame the victim.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
Yeah, and that goes to another aspect, which is the history. If there's been times that you've had something happen to you, and let's say, you know, somebody attempts to rape you, and you get away from him, and you go and you tell somebody, you tell a friend, like you told your friend, and something bad happens out of it, like that whole thing with the guidance counselor, then you're going to be a lot less likely to tell. If something else happens, the next time something comes along, you're just like, nah, I'm not going to tell again. I know what happens when I tell.
Yeah.
And so that's a big part of it.
It was kind of funny because later in life, I was 19 years old, I think it was, 19 or 20. And I had told the boyfriend that I was living with at the time. And, you know, he was a mistake in and of itself. He's 19 years older than me. It was really stupid. But anyways, I had told him about it, and I was having some pretty bad flashbacks then, and you know, I eventually left him because he was an alcoholic, and I moved back home. And the day that I got back home, you know, 7, 8, 9 states away, he called and told my parents, I'm worried about Kim. This is what happened. I know she's never told you. He completely betrayed my trust. Mm-hmm. And I was just so scared after that to tell anybody else again, because this man that I trusted told when I asked him not to.
Yeah. And there, it's a pattern then. I mean, that's the second time that you had told somebody, asked them not to tell, and they did for their own purposes.
Right. Now, he did it under the guise of wanting to protect me, and he really did. He really, truly did, but he didn't think of the consequences emotionally for me or psychologically for me, because that brought on a whole new level of dealing with the abuse and dealing with the family. You know, I personally was not ready to disclose that to my family yet. You know, there was some point within the next 1 or 2 years that I probably would have, but at that point I wasn't ready and I didn't have a choice. I had to be ready.
And I think that's really important. Now, there are mandated child abuse reporting things that go on, and people have to deal with those in ways that are legal. But in the issue of an adult telling about something that happened, it's really important that person have be able to be the one to decide when to tell, and not to have somebody kind of paternalistically saying, oh, well, you need to tell, so I'm going to tell for you.
Right, and it's completely different for an adult than for a child. You need
exactly.
to act on behalf of a child, and the adult needs to act on their own behalf.
Right.
And, you know, there's another reason why adults don't report. It's they don't want to upset anyone. It's the same thing as with kids. They work on very similar levels. They don't want to upset anyone. They think that, you know, families are going to fall apart. They're going to lose people because they think, oh, they're going to blame me. They're going to think I'm a whore, that I must have wanted it. And that comes all the way down to society's perceptions of it. And these people carry these perceptions.
Well, also just facing the demons, you know, it's like it takes a lot of work to decide, you know, to tell and stuff. And so you have this whole thing about, you know, if you tell, then you're going to have to face all the consequences of it's all of a sudden real in a way that maybe it wasn't before.
Not wanting to disrupt adjustments you've made. If a rape survivor has managed to pick up the pieces, seeking help to work through the attack can be seen as a potential disruption to the adjustment that has been made. Many victims say, I don't want to go back and remember. I just want to move forward. The problem is, there is no way to forget the incident. Instead, a great deal of emotional energy is being exerted to keep it out of awareness.
Yeah, that's really good. And I think that's true. I mean, when I first started talking about what happened with that trucker, it was a huge deal. It was devastating because I had kept that to myself, and I literally had not told anybody for 20 years. I had just put it out of my mind and said, I'm not going to think about it, not going to deal with it. And there were days after I first told, there were days where I didn't even see how I could continue to live. And I had gone for 20 years, apparently, you know, looking to the outside world as if that had not happened. So it does make it more real, and it makes the feelings more three-dimensional, and it's harder to push it back and to deny it once you have told somebody or have made it acknowledged that what happened to yourself and to others.
Right, and then there's the cultural variables. You know, some cultures view seeking professional help as a sign of weakness and dishonoring or betrayal of the family. So many people see, oh my God, you're going to a counselor? You're going to therapy? What's wrong with you? You've got some kind of a mental disease. I can't talk to you. Can't be friends with you. That's such a societal... It's just a society view that is just wrong, because everybody in the world needs therapy, and there is only a small percentage of us that actually go out and get it to help us be better persons. You know, but then there's other cultures that may be more tolerant of the violence against women, so that a person discounts their feelings of the victimization and they don't seek help.
Before we stop, there's one thing that we wanted to share with you guys, and it's also from The Courage to Heal. And it talks about why telling is transformative. We're going to read Why Telling is Transformative. The first one is, you move through the shame and secrecy that keeps you isolated.
You move through denial and acknowledge the truth of your abuse.
You make it possible to get understanding and help.
You get more in touch with your feelings.
You get a chance to see your experience and yourself through the compassionate eyes of a supporter.
You make space in relationships for the kind of intimacy that comes from honesty.
You establish yourself as a person in the present who is dealing with the abuse of her past.
You join a courageous community of women who are no longer willing to suffer in silence.
You help end child sexual abuse by breaking the silence in which it thrives. The same applies to sexual assault.
And you become a model for other survivors.
You eventually can learn to feel proud and strong.
And another thing about why telling is transformative, it's important for the survivors to tell. Not only that, but it's important for people who aren't survivors and, you know, who never had to deal with this trauma. It's important for people like that to talk about it and to spread the awareness and to say, hey, this isn't cool. Or if you hear a guy talking to his other guy and saying, oh, yeah, I saw this girl and I'm going to follow her out to her car. Tell him no. Tell him no. Don't let people suffer. Stop the abuse. And it can't just happen within the survivors group of people who have suffered this trauma. It needs to happen across the globe. And everybody needs to talk about this and educate and say, this is wrong. This is why it's wrong. Well, I think that's it for Why People Don't Tell About Abuse. We're going to play a song here and maybe another two after that. And we hope that you guys enjoy them, and we will see you next time on Forgive the Wait.
Yes, thank you.
Damage it will show. each and every day, and in every single way, it won't hurt to try. But it's easier to say, what difference can I make? So you say,
and that was Finiston in a song called It Angers Me So. To hear more songs by Finiston, you can visit them at www.finiston.com. You can also find a link to them on our show notes. You have just listened to an episode of Forgive the Wait, featuring Kim and Nikki, debunking many misconceptions regarding sexual abuse. You may visit them on the net at forgivethewait.livejournal.com or call their listener line at 206-350-8598. Are you still here? Excellent. Well, welcome to the tail end of the show, where we do outtakes from the previous recording. Now, during this recording, we had some technical difficulties. You're going to hear the rest of the outtakes, and the main problem from the show was that my recording software and my sound card malfunctioned slightly, and we had some terrible echo that we couldn't make it work for the show because it was far too distracting. And while I was trying to fix the issue, you get to hear how Nikki entertained herself.
You shut up. No, you shut up. No, you shut up.
Can we say frustration?
Dra la la boom die. Oh, row, 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 row. Merrily.
Life is but a
dream.
Oh my god. We've got to do outtakes. Holy crap.
Early life, what so proudly we have. Baseball.
Do the seventh inning stretch. Take me out to the ball
game. Take me out to the fair. Buy me some peanuts and apple jacks.
And a computer that works that doesn't echo. Ah! Okay, stop recording.
Me. Did you see Finding Nemo?
Oh yeah, I've got it.
Mine. I can get really upset about the mine.
Talk again.
No echo. No
awesome.
Echo. No
awesome.
Echo.
I fixed it.
No echo. No echo. No
okay,
echo.
Hey, freak.
Happy birthday.
Can you hear me?
To you. Happy birthday to
you. Okay, I need a drink. I'll be right back.
Happy birthday, Elmo. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? No, I can't hear you. No. No. Lovely. Hello. My name is Charles Corrals.
Oh, my God.